Welcome to Talk Without Borders. I'm your host, John Petit. In this episode, I had the pleasure of talking to Clara Muraru. She is a Luxembourg-based serial entrepreneur who has been engaged in many social and community initiatives over the last 20 years. She is also president of the Union des Indépendants, a national organization that represents and supports self-employed professionals and small business owners in Luxembourg. We talked about her journey from growing up under communism in Romania to founding her language services company in Luxembourg, her political engagement with CSV, and her current role as president of the Union des Indépendants. Clara also shared her views on the challenges of bridging the divide between Luxembourg's international and local communities, the importance of building a supportive community for independent workers, and her effort to elevate them to become a vital part of the national economy. And now, without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Clara Muraru. Hello, Clara. Welcome to my podcast.
Hello, John. Thanks for inviting me.
Before we get into your work right now and your activities as an entrepreneur, I would like to know a little bit about your early life growing up in Romania, because I think it's quite interesting to see what was your experience like growing up in Romania and what made you decide to come to Luxembourg eventually.
Yes, it was a very interesting period. And I feel even though it was a difficult period, because communism is not a lot of fun, obviously, and we didn't have a lot of products and long queues for anything we wanted to get from the shops. But it was really interesting because we were taught, in a way, the community spirit. So we had the opportunity to have a lot of activities with the colleagues, with peers, but also families. They were spending a lot of time together because we didn't have a lot of other entertainment. Then people would spend a lot of time together organizing dinners, parties in the park, in the forest. So there was this community spirit, which I think a lot of countries with less means have it. So now, because Romania, it's quite developed, so we have more this Western type of mentality, a little bit more focus on individualism, on, whatever I develop for myself. I think it's not just in Romania, it's in all countries,
Do you think that the conditions under communism, maybe the sparsity of goods, created some sort of ingenuity or creativity that you use later on in your life as an entrepreneur?
For sure. It created a certain solidarity because people are more solidary and they get together more often when they are confronted with something that doesn't work rather than when everything works perfectly well. And then also when you had not so many possibilities, not so many means, then yeah, you had to be creative. You had to be innovative and do a lot of things with very little financial means, I would say.
Does that instill a drive in you to maybe work a little bit harder than other people that did not grow up under these circumstances? Do you think in a way it gave you an advantage later on because you know what it's like to not live under optimal conditions?
I don't like to compare myself to anybody, but obviously it's a different way of being raised and not having a lot. Then you kind of like give a different meaning and value to money, but this is me. You cannot really generalize. I know a lot of people who didn't get the drive and who didn't necessarily started to value more money when they got it, when they got opportunities to work also abroad. So it's really it's very subjective, I would say.
Okay, so then I think it was around 1998. You were working on a bilateral project, I think, if I remember that correctly. When did the idea arise to move to Luxembourg? What was the main motivator behind that?
Yes, I started to work to collaborate with Luxembourg, not necessarily with the government right away, but it was with some people working for the government who went to Sibiu, Romania. We had this project of bringing awareness to a potential UNESCO heritage, World Heritage, the city, the old city of Sibiu. And I got a chance to meet all these people working for UNESCO, working for different governments. And the Luxembourgish government had a specific interest because of the common history and culture that we have between the two regions. And that's how I started to get to know some people in leadership positions in the government, in the Ministry of Culture. But it didn't start like that. I just helped them for a few years, actually, on a voluntarily basis, because I was president of a student association. So when they organized, for example, a concert in the context of the campaign Europe Common Heritage, I was the presenter, I translated all the texts, I presented all those texts. So it was, and we also did the promotion of the concert, but everything was for free, you know, it was just our, yeah, we really like to do things for the community. So, so it started like that. And then later on, when this project evolved, the Luxembourgish government has chosen a house to restore and to transform it into honorary consulate of Luxembourg, and also welcome the different other organizations.
That was in Romania or in Luxembourg?
In Sibiu. Okay. So, yes, because in the 12th century, to be more exact, in the year 1143, people from this region, it was not Luxembourg and it was not Romania, but they immigrated in that region. So they continue to speak the language. For example, the former president of Romania, he used to speak to the people from Luxembourg, even to the Grand Duke and Xavier Bettel in Luxembourgish, in something very similar to Luxembourgish. It's not the same. We call it there Saxon, but it's almost the same. So so that's how it started. They needed somebody to take care of this project, House of Luxembourg. It's called House of Luxembourg. And they asked me if I could come for 3 months to help them advance with the project. And that's what I did. So the first year I came for 3 months, then I went back. The second year they asked me to come back again for 6 months for different other projects. And it went like this for 4 years. And the fourth year I had a contract of 12 months. So I can say that the government, actually, the Luxembourgish government invested in me. So it's good that afterwards I kind of decided to stay, because they invested a little bit in me. And they got their return on the investment for sure.
and then in 2004, when you founded your company,
it was 2003 when I graduated from my MBA from Sacred Heart University. They had a second campus here, and this is what got me to stay actually after 2001, because they offered me a job. A part-time job, and they paid me with my studies and with the rent of the apartment I was staying in.
Okay.
And then I got two other part-time jobs to pay, you know, for my food and everything else.
Okay, so in 2003, and something really interesting happened, which is that you as an expatriate, so you come from Romania, and you decide to found a company, languages.eu, that teaches Luxembourgish. So what's the story behind that?
The company was never called Languages.lu. Languages.lu is a brand that I found actually a year later in 2004. Okay. That's why probably you got the year. So in 2003, I started a company, but you have to remember that at that time, we didn't have this simplified type of company. And it was really complicated for somebody who didn't have something stable here to create a company. So actually, after trying and trying, I decided to do it online. So I did it in the UK, but online with the secretary office in London. So I had a UK company. And 2004, so it was easier to just create a branch of this company in Luxembourg.
Okay.
The following year, in 2004. And that's when I started, and that's when I...
So what was the initial company about that you founded in 2003? So what was the mission statement or the intended goal?
Yes, in 2003, I started a company which is called Outsourcing Partners Limited. And it was at the beginning for IT people who were not able to have a direct contract with a company, for example, in the UK or other regions in the world. Mm-hmm. And they were going through my company.
Okay. So in 2004, that's a completely different company now that you founded, which is Languages.
In 2003 already, I started to think about, okay, since I have this company and there is this gap in the language business, why not do something in this field? So it started already in 2003. Yeah. And that's why I opened the branch.
So you saw a need in the market?
because I studied languages initially, so languages and, you know, philology and journalism, and then I did my master's in management, and then my MBA in marketing and international business. So it's kind of like, I look at the market, I look at what happens, and I saw that actually I was the only one in interpreting services. So it had nothing to do with the Luxembourgish language. Mm-hmm. I just realized that during those years, when Romania was in the process of joining the European Union, there were a lot of conferences organized, for example, about health and security at work. And it was about the transposition of the European law into the national legislation. Mm-hmm. And so they had all these different conferences in different countries, mainly in Brussels and Luxembourg. And every time I would be asked to be an interpreter there, I could see that all my colleagues were coming from abroad. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, I'm actually the only one which is not linked to a specific institution, who's kind of like freelance, you know, and this is a big deal. So why not use it for myself and use this knowledge that I have as interpreter and develop a database of people who do interpreting services for specific language combinations for different countries, different topics. And that's how I started.
So that's how you started. And then eventually your program evolved into actually teaching Luxembourgish, correct?
Teaching, not directly Luxembourgish, no. So it really evolved. So slowly people got to know about the company, and I was receiving requests from potential customers, and I was receiving CVs from teachers. So that's when I thought, okay, why not offer also language courses?
So what did they specifically tell you in these messages? So what was the main...
Oh, they were asking, okay, do you have anything? Do you have a language course for Arabic, I remember?
Okay.
Do you have a French? Do you have that? Do you mm-hmm. have the other? Because we were doing all our communication and marketing in English. So mainly our customers were mainly English speakers, so they needed French. So this is how we started with mm-hmm. French. And because we also had this Luxembourgish teachers contacting me, I thought, okay, but there is really a need here because there are not a lot of materials, not a lot of people who know about it. So why not do something also for people who would like to learn Luxembourgish but don't live here? And that's how I started this online, the first online Luxembourgish courses in 2004. And it got us a lot of promotion, a lot of publicity, free advertising, if you will, because it was so innovative and so new that...
And I think it's true because I remember, because I'm a native Luxembourger, I remember growing up, I mean, we didn't have a course in Luxembourgish, where maybe you had for like 1 year. And I remember I think most Luxembourgers don't even know the grammar of their own language, which is quite fascinating. So it's quite interesting that you were jumping on that opportunity to teach Luxembourgish.
No, I never taught myself Luxembourgish. Mm-hmm. I never taught myself.
No, give the opportunity to teach other people.
Yes. So I took myself a Luxembourgish course in the year 2000. And then in 2001, I continued, but then because I started my MBA, I didn't have time to finish it. So I had some basics of Luxembourgish, and I thought, okay, but there are no books. There are no, how are people supposed to learn this? And that's how I started. I asked some of my teachers, okay, could you create some text for me, like some dialogues? Because that's how I learned French in school. We were just imagining dialogues on different topics. And I thought, okay, could you write for me this text? Of course, I was paying her. And then she would also record some voice, you know, because I thought, you know, to learn a language, you also need to have the audio. But mm-hmm. we didn't have at that time. So we really did it with a headphone and the microphone. And we had this little, you know, very short MP3s that we linked them to words and sentences. So it was really a great project. I'm very proud of having been the first to do it in 2004.
So what did you learn about... So if you look at Luxembourg, it has quite a unique composition, right? So there's about, what is it, half and half, 0.5% Luxembourgers and 0.5% coming from foreign countries. So what's the importance of Luxembourgish from your perspective? You know, given that, you know, your company offered courses and you engage a little bit with that question. So what did you learn on the importance of Luxembourgish. Do you think it is important to learn it? Do you think it's not really necessary? What's your perspective on it?
Well, I love Luxembourgish, so it's kind of like a very easy answer for me because I really love languages in general. Oh. And being in a country that, you know, that was my new home, of course, I thought it's amazing to learn this language, except that I didn't really need it. But I thought it's something that one should do just to show that, you know, it's your home, so you learn the language. Because the other two languages, I mean, French and English, I was using them quite a lot. And I also took some German courses. Really, I wanted to cover the three official languages. But that's not easy, and not everybody gets to do it. And it depends a lot on the age. I was at that time, you know, I was still a student. So, of course, you have more availability, mental availability for learning new languages, more than one language. I didn't have children. I didn't have a lot of responsibilities. So it's kind of like you enjoy learning new things. But when you come, for example, after 40 years old with two children, you come for a new job in a new country, I don't think this is for a lot of people the priority to learn Luxembourgish, especially because there were, I mean, it's not really used a lot in the country. And that's one of the things that I'm a little bit sad about.
Do you wish people would speak it more or encourage people to speak it more?
There are two things. Encourage people to speak more and wish that people would speak it more. I wish more people would speak it around me. When I walk in the street and I hear it, for me, it's fantastic because I'm not in a Luxembourgish community to hear it on a regular basis. So it's, for me, it's kind of like, you know, it's a great opportunity to practice that language. Only when you hear it, you hear some expressions, some sentences or people, just like informal dialogues between kids or between parents and children or between teenagers in the bus. It's just amazing. For me, I have this linguistic background, so I love it. Now, encourage people to learn Luxembourgish. I think we have to be realistic. It really depends on the age of the people that we are talking about. As I said, if you're coming after 40 and you have a lot of responsibilities to take care of, and you have to learn, for example, already French or French and some German, or already maybe English, you don't speak very well. So, yeah.
Yeah, sure. I think you're right. The older you get, you know, you have more responsibilities and then you have to set priorities. And maybe learning Luxembourgish then isn't the most important thing. But yeah, I agree with you. It's probably good if you encourage people to learn a language, even though it's not as important as other languages, I think, in Luxembourg.
But one thing that has to be understood is that we cannot compare Luxembourg with other countries because very often, especially when I was involved more in, you know, in my politics, I was told, okay, but if I learn three languages already, why can they not learn also three languages? But here, those people who are saying this kind of things is they are missing the point because when you learn, you know, so many new languages as a child, there's a completely different way of learning, and the effort that you put into it is almost inexistent. While if you do it at an adult age, it's really something else. So you cannot really compare, and that's a little bit where the gap exists in the market between the locals and the foreigners who would like to make the effort. Sometimes they do make the effort, however, they don't get to use it. So
I think that's an interesting point because, you know, whenever I went, you know, I went to Germany to study, I went to the US. People are almost always a little bit jealous about Luxembourg that we speak so many languages. It's always one of the first things that they will address to you when they talk to you. And they're like, oh, you're from Luxembourg. Oh, you speak so many languages. Oh, I wish I could speak that many languages. So is that something that you encountered as well in your experience?
Yes, generally, because I do speak a few languages and I love languages. But I have to be honest, I mean, on one side, whenever I travel and I hear Luxembourgish, I'm super proud. I feel like in a secret, you know, part of a secret family.
Yeah, for sure. You and the 10 other people that speak it. Yeah.
Yes, but it's amazing. It's an amazing feeling. But on the other hand, Luxembourgish was the only language in which I was not really feeling empowered to have a speech, you know?
What do you mean by that?
Because, for example, during my political journey, if I wanted to advance quicker, or I don't know, to have deeper connections with people, it would have helped a lot to have a better, mastering better Luxembourgish.
This is a great segue because the next point I wanted to talk is about your political career. So after, you know, building your company, languages.io, having success with it, then you decided to move into politics. So what made you decide to make that switch from private business into politics?
Well, but this is in parallel. So having had a very successful company allowed me to invest time and money and energy in different projects. And the first one was about gender equality, women advancement. So I invested my time and energy and also money in parallel to languages.lu, because this was really a social initiative which was called Inspiring Women. And then at a certain moment in 2014, it's when the mayor of Sibiu, Klaus Iohannis, who I knew personally, I met him throughout, you know, those years when we had the bilateral projects between Luxembourg and Romania. And so he suddenly became a presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. So that's when I heard about all the stories that people were trying to use and manipulate the public opinion, that he wouldn't be a good fit because he's actually from a minority. So he's even though he's born and raised in Romania, he's from a German Saxon minority. And people would try to manipulate this story. We could actually get a Romanian to be president, etc., etc. And I felt in a way that, okay, but this is not fair. I mean, I was in a different country. What if I wanted to get into politics? I mean, does it mean that because I'm not from here, even though in the meantime I took the nationality, does it mean that I never have the possibility to get into politics? So this was the first idea I had about politics. And I took a political stand for the first time in my life. And it was a very simple thing because I was not involved in any political party or movements. So it was just a campaign with a selfie where I would say, okay, I vote for Klaus Iohannis. And then some other friends did the same. So it was just a little thing. Then, I mean, some people who are senators, they heard about me and they invited me to join, actually, and to become president of the party of the Romanian president. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, he became president, but in Luxembourg. So they invited me to run. This was a party which was called, it still exists, actually, the National Liberal Party. And they have actually an antenna in Luxembourg, and they also have something for all the Romanian diaspora. So they invited me to join the executive committee of the party, but for this diaspora, even though I was not even a member yet. So it was really, they saw the potential, and right away they invited me and they wanted me in. And I accepted to run also the antenna in Luxembourg. And this is how I found out that actually the political party that was in the same European family, political family, was the SV. I didn't know about, you know, about direction.
So you got into politics through Romania and...
Not in Romania, but in the Romanian party.
In the Romanian party, but they were affiliated with CSV.
Yes, they are part of the same European political family, which is called the European Popular Party. Mm-hmm. And that's how I had, as president, I had to do the official contacts, which I didn't do actually for a few years. And then when the Romanian president came to Luxembourg for an official visit, a three-day official visit, I was part of this, the different dinners, you know, state dinners, etc. And there was one specific, very important and very fancy dinner at the palace, at the Grand Ducal Palace. And there I saw again the minister who actually allowed me to come to Luxembourg, Ernai Nico Schöpke. And I told her, she asked me, what's new? So I told her, now I'm in charge of this Romanian party, Klaus Iohannis' party. And she was so enthusiastic right away. And she said, oh, then I want to see you next year on our list. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I didn't really know what that means, you know? And I didn't really know what that...
So you accidentally actually...
Just because she saw the connection, I didn't know the connection, and I didn't know that she used to be the first woman who was president of this political party of CSV. I had no idea because I never really looked into it, and I just knew her as a minister, and that's about it. She was Minister of Higher Education and Research, and the Minister of other things. She was, she had a very good career also in Luxembourg and at the European level. So, yeah, so that's how I kind of got into it. She invited me, and then I asked her, okay, but what does it mean? How does it work? And she introduced me to some people, and that's how it all started.
As you progressed your political career, what did you learn by communicating with all these different people, be it the politicians, but also the people, the voters? What did you learn about Luxembourg and the political system?
I learned a lot because I didn't know anything. I didn't have a political education. In Romania, it's not it's not something that we get in schools. And I don't think it's the case in Luxembourg either. Maybe now, there are some projects, but I didn't know anything about politics. So I just discovered. And I loved it, actually. I have to be honest. It's an experience that I really enjoyed. However, if I look back, it's kind of like it was a different world, you know. This is the biggest party, political party from Luxembourg, and it takes time to understand actually how it functions. And I understood how it functions. I understood the different levels of the decision making, etc.
So, what did you love about it? Because you said you loved it.
I loved it because I felt like for the first time I was close to Luxembourgers. You know, it felt like, okay, I'm now part of this Luxembourgish family, community, whatever you want to call it. Okay, is this a real thing? It's not really a thing because if somehow you are no longer in that activity, you're no longer part of the family, but I'm still in contact with a lot of people. So it had this feeling that you belong to Luxembourg, you belong to this community. Wow, it's, you know, you discuss with people of all ages, people who are here, from here, who are born, raised, who saw things 100 years ago. I had contact with people I normally don't have contact with. And it was really interesting. It was my new home, so it's kind of like, it gave me the feeling that I'm special, you know, that I belong to this community.
So what were your goals when you started working as a politician? What was your main goal or your priorities that you were working towards?
Well, when I first made the switch, you mentioned the switch was actually from inspiring women to politics. And at that time, I was really very much engaged in promoting gender equality and women's advancement in career. So I created a lot of things about, around this, a lot of initiatives, books, publications, awards, etc. I really wanted to make a difference. And I admired one politician, who was from this party as well, Viviane Reding. And at that time, she was vice president of the European Commission. And she passed this law proposal for 40% quota of the underrepresented gender, which usually was a woman. So 40% quotas in the boards of listed companies. And this was approved in 2013 but by the European Parliament. And it was, so the objective was to get there by 2020. So it is the case now. But at that time, it was still at the beginning. And I thought, okay, how can I have some political power like her? Because if you want to make some changes, if you want to have a contribution, you need to have political power. And so I thought, okay, let's try to do it from within a political party. I mean, I can bring all this international community that they are struggling to have contact with, just like I struggle to have contact with the Luxembourgish community. So my role was to bridge the two communities. This is how I saw it. There is a need to no longer talk about them and us, you know, them Luxembourgers and us foreigners or new Luxembourgers, but rather us. And I think this is still one of the objectives that I would like to focus my political work on, because it's not finished, and the problems could very easily arise again, and we could have a social conflict because of these differences between the two communities and not enough communication and not enough bridges between the two.
So for my reading, there's two causes that are very important to you, right? So one, a representation or equal representation of women on boards and companies, right?
Leadership positions, yeah.
Leadership positions, that's a good way to put it. And two, to connect the local Luxembourgish community with the international community. Is that about right?
Yes, that's a good summary.
Okay, so you're working towards those goals. Did you think that you were able to accomplish this, or did you have moments when you were a little bit frustrated, maybe, you know, and things didn't go as you planned? So maybe walk us a little bit to that journey, you know, working towards those goals.
Yeah, well, being in a political party, you have to go step by step. So you have to learn how it works. I had to learn everything. I had the opportunity to be involved in different organizations, but I never really had a mentor. I mean, I had unofficially a mentor in the person of Erna and Nico. It was more like to tell me what happened, when it happened, certain decisions, how were they made, certain things that normally people don't talk about, or you really have to know them very well to tell you some details like that. And so it helped me a little bit to understand who likes whom, and, you know, like things in a, like in a...
The political workings.
But it exists also in all corporations, you know. We don't call it, I mean, we do sometimes, we refer to it as politics, you know.
Yeah, it's a corporate politics, or,
but
yeah, sure.
But it's very similar.
It's very
similar, understanding who likes who supports whom. And also what's very specific in Luxembourg is that you have a lot of people who are connected through their family. So you have the Minister of Finance, whose nephew is actually also a minister. Okay, so, you know, it's kind of this kind of connections that you normally you don't know.
They call it nepotism in the United States.
Yeah. But anyway, so this kind of connections you don't necessarily understand, because you see some people who make some mistakes, and then you see some people kind of protecting them and saying, "Ah, you know, I'm going to talk to him because he's my nephew," or, you know, this kind of. So it was very interesting to discover this world, because I never had access. My mom always told me, "Get away, run away. It's not your world. It's not the good thing."
Oh, you told your mother about this, and she told you the
no. Because I come from Romania, mm-hmm. So in a lot of countries, including Romania, people think of politicians as corrupt.
Oh, okay. This general perception of politicians.
Yes. It's and this actually motivated me to bring more people into politics, because I would get all these kind of answers, and I would tell them, okay, but if you want politics to be different, you have to get yourself engaged. You have to be part of the vision of what you want to see.
Just to touch on this, because I think it's an interesting point, that is the, especially right now, the general perceptions that people have of politicians right now is, I think, from my experience, quite negative. So like you just said, they're only in for it themselves. They care about themselves. They don't care about us. So is that something you encountered as well? Maybe let's call it cynicism towards politicians.
I encounter it in the attitudes of people that I was trying to recruit into politics. I thought that this family, this political family, was too Luxembourgish. And in order for it to succeed, and you have to remember that they were no longer in power, so they were kind of like a little bit more open to new and innovative people, because, you know, this could have been a success for them in the upcoming election. So they were a little bit, I think I met them in a moment, they were more open-minded. And this was an advantage, because they were listening to my proposal and my ideas, and they kind of gave me green light for a lot of things. So my idea was to really bring a lot of non-Luxembourgers or new Luxembourgers like myself. So we are counted as Luxembourgers, but we are still seen as outsiders. But we are important, because we are here to stay. So this is our home, and we want Luxembourg to succeed, just as we want our native country to succeed.
So how do you see that development or the relationship between Luxembourgers and the international community? Are those, do you feel those are more connected right now, or are they still somewhat operating in two different worlds, let's say, where like they are a little bit detached from each other?
I think we continue to live and work in different silos. It's really my feeling. I was trying to bring these people and different communities together, but I did not succeed. I mean, I did succeed punctually.
So where's the pain point there? Have you identified exactly where I think the divergence occur exactly, that the two camps are not coming together?
You can see that you have certain activities, you know, activities, for example, political activities, they are mainly Luxembourgish. So you only speak Luxembourgish, which I can understand, because if it was in Romanian politics, of course, we would also just speak Romanian. But then it's kind of like majority of Luxembourgish people and, you know, the outsiders would very rarely be able to join. And the same is like you have a Spanish-speaking community and only people who speak Spanish, they would gather. And then you have the English-speaking community there. Then again, you have different communities and different groups. And it's, you just have a lot of different groups. And very, very rarely, you have some events or some initiatives that truly bring them together. And politics, for the moment, I feel it's not one of them. You can bring them together through sports. You can bring them together through language learning, sharing, cultural events, etc. But politics for the moment is not. However, during a few years, I was able to bring people. For example, I started something that was called the Let's Demystify Politics. And I was organizing visits of the parliament, of the Luxembourgish parliament. And I had 1 year, almost more than 1,000 people who would come and who would discuss with members of the parliament. And this was really, really nice, because then people would tell me, oh, I never thought that politics could be so interesting. And they would kind of like change their opinion about politicians. And I was trying really to explain that politicians here is different than maybe in other countries where it's somebody non-accessible or very difficultly accessible. Here, it's your neighbor. Anybody could be in politics. You could be in politics. So please come and join and you know, join the discussion if you don't join the party. So there was a good ambiance in a way, and we were going to a good objective, I felt. But then this takes time, and you really have to have some people who are committed and who have this mindset, and you cannot expect in 3 years this to happen or in 7 years. It takes really a long period of time.
Just want to put my own personal experience. About, although this is anecdotal, but because I lived here and then I went to the US for 7 years. And before I left, I felt it was very French centric. So everything was in French, all the laws, the regulations, the administrative stuff was in French. And now that I come back, I feel like English has become more prominent. Although I don't know if that's just me, or is that something that has really happened as a development over the years?
I think it happened. I feel it as well. But in the same time, I feel that Luxembourgish has become really predominant.
Luxembourgish, okay.
So you have these two languages which really evolved. When I started to languages.li, for example, English was not a lot used.
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
But now everybody speaks English. It's also because you have certain communities like the Indian community, which is one of the growest communities from Luxembourg. And these people usually speak English. I mean, they learn French or a little bit of French, and they learn Luxembourgish to the level to get the nationality. However, yeah, the main communication remains to be done in English.
So you switched, and I don't, because I know you're doing a lot of things at the same time. So, but then you also switched your attention towards the Union des Indépendants, right? So helping small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and independent workers, right? So what made you decide to go into that area? Is it now you're operating as a president?
Yes, this was because when the COVID hit, we realized that in the past, I mean, before COVID, we didn't really have a problem to pay a lot of money and social security and taxes, whatever. I mean, we were happy as independent workers. I had my company. It was very successful when the COVID hit. we lost from one day to the other a lot of business. I mean, I personally lost about 80% from one day to the other. And I can see the decline every year. So there are more and more competitors who decide to voluntarily go bankrupt. So we could see suddenly that, okay, we've been working for a lot of years. We paid our taxes, our social security. But when a big crisis arrived, we didn't have any kind of support. I mean, we did, but it was something that could not support a family. So we only received 3,500 euros one time in 2020 and one time in 2021. This is really not enough when you're paying both parts as employer and as an employee. And we could see the difference because our employees would receive 80% from the state, but we wouldn't. So it's kind of like there is a huge gap in understanding that if independent workers are not doing well, there will be no more employees who work for these independent workers in those companies, because we have to always keep in mind that more than 80% of companies in the European Union are small and medium companies. These small and medium companies are run or created or run by independent workers like myself. If we are not doing well, at a certain point in time, all these employees will have to be supported financially by the state, by all the other people, all the other citizens. And also there is a gap in understanding that you have different types of self-employed. You have those who are indeed employers, so they employ other people, they create companies, they create other jobs for other people. Then you have the employees, which are, okay, we know exactly. And then you have fonctionnaires, but also working for certain companies or institutions. But then you also have those who are neither employers, neither employees. Mm-hmm. Those who work on their own name. Yeah, so we call them freelancers.
Freelancers, yeah.
Freelancers, but they are actually in the same box as in the same category as independent workers. And they pay the two parts. They pay the employer's part and the employee part, but they are no employers. So we are just told that this has been like this forever. But these people, for example, during the COVID also, they didn't receive anything at all, even though they were paying both parts again. So it's kind of like you want these people to pay, they're paying, but when there is any crisis at all, they have no rights.
So is the problem that the government doesn't provide enough financial assistance and also not enough infrastructure? So I would assume it's both of those things, right?
Well, first of all, it's the way that Social Security is structured. We've been told forever that this is the way it works. But there are certain other countries where it doesn't work like that. But we are told, no, in all the countries it's like that. You have to pay the employer's part and the employee's part. No, there are certain countries like the UK, if you are a freelancer, you only pay for the employee's part because you are not an employer. You employ yourself indeed, so you don't ask the government to pay you anything. You are not asking any funding, anything at all. You create your own job. And you pay for it and that's it. But here it's like you pay for both parts, but you don't get not even at the level of your employees. And that's not going to be sustainable in the future. That's not going to be sustainable because how can you pay? I mean, since the COVID, when I saw this difference, I'm speaking to a lot of independent workers. They tell me, most of them, I don't want to have employees anymore. Why should I sacrifice everything, my time, my money, my energy, and then...
There's no economic incentive.
No, because usually when you take a risk, for example, in finance, you take a risk, you are remunerated for that risk. But when you are an independent worker, you are not only remunerated, but in a way discriminated. Because you are discriminated when you want to go to get a loan, when you want to have access to certain services, to open an account even. You are discriminated. If you are not an employee, it's so much more difficult for you. You are discriminated, for example, as a self-employed by the ITM. I have some members who tell me, we feel harassed by the ITM. ITM is this Inspection du Travail, which is looking at the rights of employees, whether or not you are abusing your employees. And certain of our members, they say, we really feel we are harassed. And then there are some changes also. For example, the administration of contribution, they suddenly just decide that they change the interpretation of a certain law. But they don't provide any kind of explanation. Why? Why? For many years, for example, those who have created a company and they employ themselves in the company as a gérant or manager, whatever they want to call themselves, and they were able to pay the employer's part through the company. Why not? I mean, they created that company and they work for that company. So why they should not be able to pay the employer's part through the employer, which is actually the company? So suddenly, the Administration des Contributions in 2022, they decided that, okay, this is no longer allowed. Why? Because they changed an interpretation.
When you bring up these concerns to people in the government or the responsable in French, what is the response that you usually get?
We are still at the beginning. We only started last year, so we have to understand how this works.
Sure, it's a process. It's a process.
Yes, it's a process. We need to consolidate the union because also independent workers, they are very often used to be alone, right? Independent, very independent, not to ask for anything, even if they are having a lot of struggles, because it's their reputation, you know, in play. If they say that they have some struggles, then they are afraid that potential customers would no longer come to them. So it's a vicious circle.
Yeah, it's in the nature of the word, right? So they're independent, right? So that means they are independent and they'd rather figure out things on their own rather than consult with a union, I would assume.
Yes, but now the abuses are becoming more and more significant.
Abuses from who?
From, for example, you have companies, corporations, and even government who employ them. And then there is not abuse, maybe the best word is discrimination. So discrimination in the way they are paid or they are no longer paid.
Oh,
or
I mean,
they are...
Sure, but for freelancers, I feel like this has always been the case that they've been abused.
Yes, but is it abused? Because it's always been the case, doesn't mean mm-hmm. that it's okay.
Sure, no, it's not. It's of course, I mean, I worked as a freelancer for a very long time. So I can attest to that, yes.
Yeah, but you can see that in other parts of the world, for example, in New York, in the state of New York, they managed, the freelancers union, they managed to get a law, to implement a law to be approved by the state that freelancers and independent workers should be paid 30 days after they invoiced.
Okay.
So that's okay. That's a huge, you know.
That's one step, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, that's one step. And I remember when I started my company, there was a discussion about something like, you know, similar to that in Europe, to have something at the European level. There was a directive saying that you should be paid 30 days after you invoice your customer. And if you're not paid, then you can have add some interest. In any case, there are a lot of things that could be done. They have to be done in the future. We need to organize ourselves, to structure a little bit our request, to bring more proof to the government, to explain them what we would like to see changed. Because in the future, I mean, we can see that the younger generations, they want to have this this flexibility, this independence to work. And you can see that it's already difficult to employ people. So this would be one alternative for companies to have skilled staff, but in the same time to have stuff that is not necessarily linked forever to them. So it's a trend. It's a trend and we need to adapt ourselves. This is a new way of working and we cannot say, oh, we cannot do anything because independent workers are not in the code du travail, in the work. Yeah, this is what we are told. We cannot do anything because you are not linked to Ministry of Employment.
Is that your goal eventually to get them into the Code du Travail?
But we need to at least acknowledge that they exist. You know, right now, the only thing that shows that we have also independent workers on the market as workers, it's the fact that the Employment Ministry decided to write a specific paragraph in the Code du Travail, which says that also independent worker could benefit of parental leave. So there is a possibility, you see. So if they benefited of parental leave, they could also benefit from a salary replacement in case of a crisis. like it was during COVID. I mean, we need to prepare for a new crisis because it might come. And what do we do with all these people? We leave them again in the rain?
Yeah, to provide more protection for independent workers.
Yes, because right now you have nothing. We have nothing as independent workers. If you are sick, okay, you pay an extra to mutualité des employeurs. So you could be taken to, you know, also during the 77 days that normally the employer pays, but you have to pay something extra. But those payments that you do as an employer, they don't really bring you anything back. They don't bring you what this would bring to an employee. They receive some days, like, for example, 3 days if one of your parents has deceased, or you have a lot of different possibilities for employees. But if we pay for the two parts, why we don't get as well a minimum of days that are paid, a minimum of holidays that are paid? I mean, we're paying for the employer's part as well. So it should be, we should get it. Otherwise, we should no longer pay for the employer's part. And then, okay, I agree, then we don't get it.
Do you think that part of the roadblocks right now or resistance is what I would call maybe a little bit of a bloated public sector and maybe a cultural problem, that maybe the incentives are heavily focused towards public sector and not so much towards private business or small and medium-sized businesses? Do you think that there's an inherent problem with that right now in Luxembourg?
I mean, it's normal. It's like you have the answer in the question. We know that this is the reality. We have a lot of people who are working, like Luxembourgers who vote, who work for the state, for the government, for the Gemengen, so semi-statal, fully funded or public, private sector funded. So, yeah, there is a misunderstanding as well of what it means to be an independent worker. So we need to also educate the public. But of course, we need more resources to be able to do that. We need to demystify the status of independent worker, to explain, well, an independent worker is not just the work that they do when, I don't know, they sell you the meat, for example. Yeah, they sell you the meat, but yeah, they had to negotiate the prices of the meat. They had to transport it to the shop. They had to hire people to work there. They have to do the invoicing. They have to, like, a lot of different things that an independent worker has to do by himself or herself. A lot of responsibilities, and it's becoming more and more difficult. And also during COVID, we saw some people who took their lives because they just couldn't stand with all these responsibilities and this isolation in terms of you know, how do you deal with all these things? You have to be God. You have to be good in accounting. You have to be good in the content creation. You have to be good in so many things. And it's just one person. So if you go into depression or chronic stress, for example, 43% of independent workers suffer of chronic stress. Nobody helps you. You just go down. You just and then it's just, yeah, you don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And some people took their lives, unfortunately, because it's just too much. So we need to think now instead of 10 years from now when it will be too late. So now we can still find some solutions. We can still create a community of support. For example, ADEME, they only give to employees certain trainings. But it's not normal. If we pay also the employer's part, why we cannot get also some trainings to upskill ourselves, to learn new skills, to create maybe a different activity, to go into more into AI, using AI. I mean, we need to be always so much aware of everything that happens, not just in terms of technology, but also in terms of changes in the society and environment, etc. So we need some kind of support.
Do you feel that your message is received, or people are receptive towards that message? Or do you think there's still a lot of work to be done to convince people of what the state is, independent worker, and why it is beneficial to help them?
I think it will take some time for us to get a little bit more organized and to have more members and to have a bigger voice, because as a union, as a syndicate, you're as important as the number of members that you have. And you are just like we are 1,700 for the moment. I don't think they really take us seriously for the moment.
Okay, so strength in numbers.
Yes, so we need to grow our numbers. We need to consolidate the union, and in parallel, in the meantime, we need to work on our request on some solutions that could be possible, to bring them some examples from other countries, how it works in other countries, because they just have one idea that it works like that. It's been working like that for a century. So why change it now? And we saw that recently there was this report about the European pensions, and who is suffering the most? Independent workers and women.
Yeah. So if you reflect on where you are today, just so we can round out the conversation, if you're looking forward into the future, what do you think is working well right now in Luxembourg? And what do you wish to see maybe, let's say, 5 or 10 years down the road, where you would feel satisfied that is a positive development?
I think we are too much dependent on foreign workers. It's almost 80% that we depend on foreign workers, either who live in Luxembourg or frontalier. It's 50%. It's a too high percentage. So we need to see how to deal with this international community, how to better integrate them in a way that they will feel somehow linked to the country. Because when something works, everybody wants to be here. But when something no longer works, then we have the risk that they will go back to whatever country they came from if they don't really feel linked and that their roots are in Luxembourg. So we need to prepare this kind of, you know, better social cohesion between people, between different nationalities, different types of working environments and types of employment. I think this is really the biggest thing that I would see, because we don't have a lot of time. So it's really kind of like, this would be the point to avoid a social conflict in the future, I think. But everything is changing. So it's we have seen so many changes during the last 10, 20 years. Politicians and people who are in decision-making positions, I mean, they have to be able to have access to so many information, so much data from different fields of activity that it's not an easy position they are in. You know, so we all kind of need to get together and to keep in mind, okay, our happiness depends on how wealthy and how well our country works. So if you really want to stay here forever, I mean, you see yourself in Luxembourg, then okay, do your part, get involved however you can, get involved in your community, in your village, in your nonprofit association, your for-profit activity, you know, do something. Don't just stay like, you know, you just go to work, you go home, you eat. It's just, you know, get a little bit more interest in your country, because on each and every one of us depends the future of Luxembourg, I would say.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think those existence of two different silos is probably something that we need to break up and, like you said, create a bridge between the two communities. But I also recognize it's probably not that easy. So, you know, it probably, as you said, it takes time. You have to, in some ways, I think, break up the existing culture in Luxembourg, which is a little bit too focused on public sector, right? So part of the initiative, I think, is also change minds and say, okay, look, it is important that we do support independent workers because X, Y, and Z, this is beneficial too. So like you said, maybe provide some data, some evidence, right? So as we move forward, we can work towards that goal. But in any case, I think you made some really great points. So yeah, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's very informative. Thank you.
Thank you so much, John.